Welcome to this unusual event, a joint meeting of USAID and USIP, and we're pleased to experiment in this format. You know, it's my honor usually to make a few lightweight remarks at the beginning that set the context. And, of course, I can do that in the sense that I can mention that now that Iraq has a constitution that does a good deal in the way of devolving power away from Baghdad and towards its one region so far, as well as the governorates and local communities, that it's particularly important to be looking at the role of local governance as a foundation for democracy in Iraq. And I will make that remark. But I also am faced with the difficulty of putting this in the context of what's going on in Washington, D.C. today. And I would only note that two people have said to me today, asked me about the reorganization of the State Department, and I guess I didn't read it quite that way. I thought our diplomacy was being transformed or becoming transformational. And it seems to me this is a direction things have been going in for a long time, a direction that we at USIP have certainly encouraged in the State Department. I think there are quite a few people in AID as well who feel the need for our diplomacy to be more out there, more among the people, and more concerned with transforming things than with the traditional stability issues that that diplomats are always concerned with. Local governance is where the rubber hits the road when it comes to transformational diplomacy. And I don't know a lot of places I regard as well-governed only from their capitals. It seems to me local governance is really important, often ignored, because after all, who represents us abroad? A national government officials represent us abroad, and it's a whole lot easier to deal with a single government in Baghdad or in Kabul than with 18 governorates or something like that. So it naturally is the habit in diplomacy not to worry too much about local governance, and I think we do need to. At the same time, I can't help but note that USAID has not only acquired a new administrator, and we welcome him and congratulate him, but he has acquired a new title as well, a new function, I might say, in coordination of foreign assistance, and it's going to be interesting to watch how that shakes out. Before I turn the floor over to people who know more than I do about these things, I wanted to read to you something that comes from a colleague who has often been at these meetings, young Major Ben Connable, whom a number of you may know from these meetings, and my cousin. So I feel some liberty to use his words. He's given me permission. The young major is currently in Ramadi, and he's in a particularly sensitive position in Ramadi because he's working the intelligence beat for the Marines. But he gave me permission to read some of this, and let me do that. There is a snowballing grassroots movement at the town-city level by local Iraqis to take charge of local security, push out foreign fighters, and generally to reassume control over their day-to-day lives. They want us out. But we hear over and over again from city to city, village to village, household to household, that they need us to stay until the Iraqi security forces are ready to take charge. Local city councils are springing up in places that had previously been under the control of insurgents. We're seeing a growing effort by Sunni tribal leaders, technocrats, and bureaucrats to inject themselves into the political process before it's too late. Fallujah is far from perfect, but it's a miracle compared to 2004. I can't believe the meeting reports coming out of the city council. People are energized about the elections and are generally happy about the way things are going. What strikes me most is the way the tribal leaders and local elites are talking. When I was here last, their focus of effort was on us. We were ruining the cities. We were responsible for their problems. We were occupiers. Now they seem intently focused on themselves and on improving the Iraqi government. They talk about economic issues, about getting rid of foreign fighters, about making the Baghdad government work for them. Anyway, I thought this was a fitting introduction to some people who not only know about the question of local governance in Iraq, but who have been there and done some of it and have a lot of experience that I hope will shine through in their presentations. Without further ado, let me introduce Michaela Meehan, who will open things up. We'll then move to Ron Johnson, Dana Eyre, and Patrick Garvey. Michaela.
Thank you, Dan. And I'd like to join Dan Sorer and USIP in welcoming you all here today. Thank you very much for being here on a topic that USAID feels is of considerable importance. As the email that Dan just read, I'm not sure I have a lot to add because that really does get to the heart of what we're trying to do with our local governance program. I'd like to make some opening remarks in terms of laying a foundation for some of the other presenters who will speak in more detail about our local governance program, but I'm here more to speak in terms of why local governance and why is it a foundation for democracy in Iraq. As democracy practitioners, we rightfully view democracy as a road to peace and stability, economic prosperity, and a means to achieving personal aspirations for all of a nation's citizens. However, we must be careful to remind ourselves that democracy is also inherently conflictual. There are electoral winners and there are electoral losers. Therefore, we who actively promote democracy and implement assistance programs must ensure that the winners recognize the rights of those not elected and those who fail to gain office have a meaningful and respected role within society as part of a loyal opposition, civil society, or in independent media and in all aspects of private life. As partners in our assistance program, nearly all Iraqis see the value and benefits of a democratic system of governance, but for some, and not just the elite within society, they also see a potential threat, a loss of power or status, an avenue for foreign influence, or an increase in the sheer number of quote-unquote unknowns. These fears are particularly acute in the early stages of an emerging democracy from a formerly totalitarian regime, such as we have in the case of Iraq, where there is a weakness throughout society in understanding not only the rights, but also the responsibilities that must necessarily accompany a successful democracy. In order to address these fears, it is important to offer Iraqis the opportunity to plot their own course towards an Iraqi democracy and share in the nation's governance, wealth, defense, culture, and identity. It is well accepted that there are many required components for building democracy, a rule of law that guarantees freedom of expression, association, and religion, free, fair, transparent, and regular elections, good governance that fairly represents and provides for all of its constituents, protects against corruption, effectively manages the country's resources and its relationships within the international community, and a vibrant civil society that promotes collective interest and serves as a watchdog on the government. Or to quote a colleague of mine in Iraq, she said earlier this week, to empower civil society organization and independent media to be proactive and be a bulldog to prod government to behave democratically. I would argue and I would posit that most of you would agree with me that all of these are required, none are optional. where we might engage in debate, and some of us have and will continue to do so, is in decisions to sequence the building blocks or build simultaneously, or which ones to emphasize under which conditions at what point in time. Today, however, I would like to underscore the importance of building the institutions, capacity, and legal framework of local government. This is not to say that investments in rule of law, elections, and civil society are not critically important for Iraq's future as a democratic state. All politics may not be local, but local governance is what people see and feel most palpably. What I'd like to focus on is one example of that. Under the Iraqi constitution that was recently passed, personal law family status is determined to be outside of the national jurisdiction, and yet that is a province that is clearly most important to everyone's daily life, and I think it underscores the importance of local government in the Iraqi context. Therefore, local governance offers a tremendous opportunity to improve people's daily lives as the beneficiaries of essential services and directly influence their perceptions of government at large. Although Iraqis have not yet elected their municipal leaders, the election of the provincial councils and their subsequent appointment of governors provides us as a donor community with a legitimately elected subnational cadre of politicians with an obligation to represent the populace. In addition, the appointment of cabinet members by a cascading decision of the Council of Representatives and their subsequent selection of local department heads of line ministries offers the same legitimacy with regard to the central agencies at the local level. This work is important, as much for improving service delivery as it is for decentralizing control over budgets, staffing, and priorities, building local ownership of problems and solutions, leveling the playing field between Baghdad and the provinces, preventing recentralization of decision-making, and allowing for citizens to be heard and influence their government. This work is challenging even in a stable, peaceful environment, but the imperative is that much greater in violence-prone areas. Capacitating and empowering local leaders and communities to peacefully address needs and resolve conflict undermines the incentives for armed resistance and resentment of foreign powers. Thank you.
Thank you, Michaela. Ron, when I started asking around about who knew the most about local governance in Iraq, you were elected by your colleagues. So tell us what the situation is. You can do it either from there or from the podium, as you like.
Maybe easier. Not that I'm eager to stand up, but I think some of you in the back have a hard time seeing me if I speak from there. I have some PowerPoint slides that I'd be happy to provide copies for later. But before I get, who's going to run those, by the way? Are you in charge of that, Dana?
I'm sitting in front of you. Tell me where they are.
Senior fellow Dana Ayer has taken charge of the PowerPoint.
I have no idea.
Okay.
I think an expert is coming to the front.
Yeah, where do we have
I guess the first question I'd have to ask you is, and by what electoral process, and was I on a party list, and where did I come on that party list?
It's a national list.
I'm not sure it was a transparent election. It sounded more like a single district.
It was a caucus.
Oh, that's a hard word to use in the context of our discussion. Excuse me. What I would really like to focus my remarks on, and hopefully I have a feeling that we're preaching to the choir here, certainly among the people at the table. I think there's going to be broad spread agreement, and I probably know a third of you here in the room, and I doubt that there are among those third that I know there are none of you who would say, well, no, local governments is not an important facet, maybe the critically important facet to achieving a stable and democratic society in countries like Iraq and in Iraq specifically. So I don't think the job today is to be persuasive about the importance. The job is to understand where Iraq is now along that path and what would have to be done if we're going to achieve some of the aims that the Iraqis have for themselves. I was particularly taken with your quote from your cousin as well. The thing that I particularly appreciated about it was about the last sentence or the next to the last sentence, making the government in Baghdad work for us. And that's a critical element where we are today in terms of the transition, because not only, as Michaela pointed out, is Iraq coming out of a totalitarian, totally centralist system, it's coming out of a system in which there was no system of local governance. I mean, of course, there were services delivered, and they were delivered in the various, either poorly or well, in the various cities. And, of course, there were people responsible for those services. But you have to keep in mind that, first, the governors were appointed, and appointed personally by Saddam Hussein himself. And secondly, there were no representative councils. There were no locally elected councils. There were no councils at all. There was a provision in some constitutional changes that were made during the previous regime for the creation of councils, but the councils were never implemented, and they were never intended to be elected. So let's go ahead and start with you do get to wind up being the PowerPoint jockey there. I don't need to spend any time on the first slide because it really represents things that Michaela has already pointed out. What are some of the fundamental characteristics necessary to a democratic and stable society? And it's there are numerous different formulations, but the one I want to focus on, of course, is a system of governance in which the populace can observe and hold accountable their leaders. What the Iraqis never had the opportunity to do this would be characteristic of any centralized, totally centralized system, is really be able to observe firsthand what their political leaders are doing and then be able to hold them accountable. And that's the difference in any country. As one decentralizes or begins to emphasize the responsibility and authority at a subnational level, is to begin to put governance as the fundamental operation of the use of political power in the society closer to the citizens. It's to put government, the institutions of governance, in a position where the population can observe their actions, and if you have a system that permits, throw the rascals out of office if they don't behave in the way that you want them to. And that's the framework that the Iraqi constitution that was adopted in the referendum in December, that's the framework by which that's the framework for the society there, that the provincial councils now and below the provincial councils, district and sub-district councils, will be elected. There already are elected provincial councils in Iraq. They were elected last January at the time that the National Assembly, the first elected National Assembly, provincial councils were elected then, obviously still part of the interim government, the pre-constitutional government. The elections for the new provincial councils have not been held yet. Dana, if you wouldn't mind pushing, thank you. Why local government? Echoing some of the themes, but one of the things I want to particularly focus on, two elements, the winner-take-all syndrome. Some societies are highly centralized, but are relatively benign in terms of their behavior. They may not offer full opportunity for democratic expression. They may be terribly inefficient because decisions that are made centrally, especially about investments in infrastructure and about the delivery of services, may not work so well if guided from the center, but they're not particularly intended, and the behavior of central officials is not necessarily intended to be adverse to the local populations. Iraq was not like that. It was a winner-take-all society in which once you were on the losing side, that the consequences could be very severe and certainly could involve the loss of life, loss of freedom. It's a society in which once one controlled central government, as Saddam Hussein did, and his particular appointees, once you had the control of that, then you were, if you were not part of that group, you had little opportunity, no opportunity to express your views, and certainly no opportunity to influence the system. So winner-takes-all politics takes on different forms. It had an especially pernicious form in Iraq. Local government, on the other hand, represents, generally speaking, low-intensity political conflict. Not always the case. I mean, we've had, even in our own society, at times in our history, local governments where the contest for control of local government was both violent and bitter. We've gotten past that in our history, but by and large, when you have a society that has considerable role for subnational governments, be it states, provinces, whatever it may be, and considerable authority at that level, you have the opportunity for the political conflict to be dispersed, both geographically dispersed, but also dispersed among the groups. There are only about four provinces in Iraq that are extremely varied in terms of the population group, many of them are relatively homogenous. And in those relatively homogenous, but once you add it up at the national level, and you have a winner-take-all society, winner-take-all system, then you don't have the opportunity for the losers to have to share in anything once that's done. If we could go on to the next. I'm going to make that last point about a laboratory for experimentation later. What's the status then? Why a local government strategy, particularly in Iraq? Well, the reality is, and I think your reflection again from your cousin out in Anbar province, Michaela and I also were at a meeting with a roundtable with the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force out at Camp Pendleton last week that are going out. There's a great deal of evidence that there is more and greater influence in Iraqis taking a hold of things more at the local level. But the insurgents still don't trust. And I'm speaking, when I use the word internal, I hope I don't mean to attach a lot of value to these terms. I'm not meaning to use the term in terms of, you know, there's good insurgents and bad insurgents or anything like that. I simply want to distinguish between those who are Iraqis who have been living in Iraq, whose history is there, and who are still participating in violence against some system. Sometimes it's violence against U.S. troops. Sometimes it's violence against the Iraqi military or the police or civilians. There is still a great deal of distrust in the system that's emerging, even though in this past election, the Sunnis particularly participated in very large numbers, having sat out the elections last January and participated not nearly as extensively in the constitutional referendum in October. The Iraqis do not own at this time the results of the reconstruction program. The U.S. has been monetarily generous and generous in terms of lives spent in Iraq, and yet the Iraqis don't yet own the fruits of the reconstruction process because they don't view it as things that they have done for themselves. And except for those who are going to come out as the primary winners at the central level, Iraqis in many cases don't yet own the institutions of governance. That's the task set out in front of us. Dana? Thanks. I'm disadvantaging Dana. He's busily looking at his notes, getting ready to figure out what he's going to say, having heard from Michaela and me, trying to figure out what he should cut and what he should add. And I have to interrupt him periodically here. What the U.S. program in Iraq now is doing to address these issues is represented by a couple of slides here. At the province level first, but cascading down to levels below the province, one can come up with any kind of reasonable list of skill building, capacity building, and emphases that need to take place, and this is a pretty reasonable list that reflects the program of it reflects the ambassador's intent, it reflects the USAID mission director's intent, it reflects the U.S. military's intent. And I think I would have to say, without meaning anything particularly critical of the leadership in the U.S. effort in Iraq up to now, this is the strongest and most coherent set of coordinated agreement, I think, among the military, the assistance programs of USAID, and the embassy and State Department that I've seen. That doesn't mean we don't have some more work to do, but there is a strategy going forward that emphasizes focus heavily on getting the subnational institutions who can defuse some of that political conflict I referred to earlier. And these particular skills that we want to talk very briefly about. Next slide, please. Main focus of the program in terms of the political institutions is on this new political institution of the provincial and then subsequently the district and sub-district councils. Since it is a brand new institution, there is no experience in Iraq to go back to and say, well, like in some previous regime, this is what council members elected council members who have legislative authority, this is what they do. So a great deal of the focus of the effort is on training the council members in the role of a council in a democratic society, a council that has authority. What kind of authority these councils have? As Michaela pointed out, they have the authority to appoint and implicitly the authority to remove the governor. In addition, they have the authority to review the budgets and approve the budgets of the technical service providing departments, even though those technical service providing departments are still the deconcentrated elements of central ministries. Local government has not been created, and all personnel providing services have been somehow turned over to a local government institutions. These are central ministries with their personnel located in the various provinces, dealing with water, sewer, streets, lighting, sanitation, whatever. But the authority that the locally elected provincial council has, which will be difficult to exercise, but is there in the Constitution, is to review and to approve the budgets, and presumably, in disapproving a budget, to send it back to Baghdad for change. That, of course, will be the critical challenge. If you send it back to Baghdad, does Baghdad respond? That's where I particularly empathize with the I assume Marine Major, but maybe with make Baghdad work for us. They're critical elements at the national. Next slide, please, Dana. The political legitimacy question is resolved in part, of course, by the electoral process. The national government that is being formed now obviously has been elected by the Iraqis themselves in accord with the constitution that they wrote. And that will be true of the provinces and the districts and sub-districts when those elections are held. But the other aspect, next slide please, the other aspect of that is, can these institutions at the local level be effective in providing for citizens the basis of their of the public services? Can they be effective in improving the service situation? And so an important element of the program going forward is to ensure that the councils as well as the technical service department heads and their technical staff are fully on board with the responsibility and the means to provide direct services to the population, to provide them in response to citizen input. Just as local governments didn't exist in Iraq and therefore Iraqis weren't used to making decisions at the local level, these local governments don't have a precedent or a history to rely upon of looking to how do you get citizens involved in the process. And so getting citizens involved in the planning and the delivery of public services and being transparent and open in the processes for not only for planning services but for letting out bids for construction, for reporting to the population on the progress. I don't think that's going to be a particularly difficult process. Many of the council meetings in Iraq have been televised since they were by local in the larger cities, even though sometimes those council meetings go on for 8 hours. And I understand that the local population tends to watch those. Well, hooray for them and boo on us, because how many of you have watched a local council meeting on television for more than about 15 minutes? Now, if it's a zoning issue in an area where you live, maybe you went to that council meeting, but I bet you didn't watch it on television. Patrick, one of our staff members in the back, and I attended a televised meeting, part of a televised meeting of the Hill Council, more than a year and a half ago now. This is not something brand new, even though the elected councils. But the whole process of engaging citizens in the oversight of government and its performance is a critical element in the process going forward. Dana? And this pretty much will be the concluding issue. Having said this, quite positive things, at least I hope you take them as quite positive aspects of what's already happened in Iraq and what is likely to happen going forward, there are some critical issues that still have to be resolved at the national level. We should not pretend that Iraq has become a highly decentralized system. The framework is there for it, but the national leaders are not necessarily accustomed either to thinking about division of responsibility between the center and subnational government. And there are critical issues there. One of those critical issues clearly is, how's the resource distribution going to work? Who's going to make decisions? What kind of distribution of, say, oil revenue is going to take place? How will provinces that do not have oil, that do not produce oil, how will they benefit in this national resource? By what process will revenue be shared between the state, the nation state, and the provincial institutions of government and within the provinces below the level of province? That's a critical issue that has to be resolved. It is not resolved in the Constitution. On the other hand, I wish I really had hoped I could say today the number of members of the new national government, National Assembly, that came from local government. I still don't have that because the election results aren't quite released, and it will still take a bit more to identify. But we do know that some 40 to 50, maybe as many as 70 people running for the National Assembly in some of the major parties who did win a lot of votes, the parties, that is, I don't know about the individuals and their placement on the list, have previously served in the currently elected provincial councils or some of the earlier councils that were formed. So one of the U.S. efforts going forward is to work to form a caucus in the National Assembly, a caucus that will represent the interests of local government. It may be only 15 or 20 that get elected, but it seems fairly certain that some number of the members of the new National Assembly will have served in local government since April of 2003 and will have had to try to address these problems. So one of the means of influencing that process is to get people in the National Assembly who care about that and who have already had to experience that. Likewise, we have, and we've had that experience, even the previous National Assembly had a number of members who previously served since April of 2003 in some local government capacity or another, or as a governor. On the technical side, the U.S. effort will include establishing a network of public administration institutes to try to transform the administration, the administrative system in Iraq. So these are some of the mechanisms that are going forward. Much of this is going to have to be dealt with through specific enabling legislation, which I've labeled in this slide a local government code. It's not necessarily the case that the National Assembly will codify everything in one document called a local government code, as some countries do. It might be in that form, or it might be in the form of numerous different pieces of enabling legislation. Given the level of conflict about some of the issues, like resource sharing, I think you could make a fair prediction that it probably will be numerous pieces of legislation and rather than one single piece of legislation. Okay, Dana? I think that's the... good. I do want to extend my appreciation for the opportunity to be here, and particularly to be here with this group at the front table. And if we can increase the transparency of the electoral process by which the members of the panel were selected, the next time maybe we can catch up with the Iraqis.
Thank you, Ron. I should have mentioned in my introduction the Institute's appreciation for RTI's very informal help in identifying some people for us when we started working in Iraq and training local leaders in dealing with inter-ethnic conflict in their own communities. RTI very helpfully suggested a number of names to us and was very cooperative in that effort. I met Dana Ayer about that time. He was part of the coalition provisional authorities cadre in Baghdad, and Dana has worried about democracy at the grassroots in Iraq from the very first. So, Dana?
Ron was right. As I was busily flipping slides there, I also was busily editing my talk, and in the interests of full disclosure, I mean, part of the reason for that is both Ron and Michaela and I have spent a lot of time together in Iraq thrashing through the issue of local governance, what we should be doing, how we should be doing it, and how to move the larger project of helping Iraqis build a democratic Iraq forward. A lot of bottles of wine and a lot of thought have gone into, it's not an accident, it really is kind of a consensus in thrashing out problems. That said, I think what I will do is, besides editing en route, also use my role as a senior fellow at USIP to be a little bit more critical of the U.S. government's approach to local government development, as well as to some of the particulars of the program thus far. First off, I think it's important to point out that local government as an issue really has an unfortunately unique place in the history of the U.S. effort in Iraq. I think it is probably the most ignored critical issue in Iraq. In contrast with electricity or training of the army or elections or other hot issues, local government was really recognized
very early by the CPA as a central concern. That's why in the CPA statement of objectives, in the CPA argument about what it was doing, it specified a federal Iraq. And yet, at the same time, there was a real distance from and a misunderstanding of and a gross lack of funding of the local government program. So I think it's I don't want to. This is not a critique of the efforts undertaken. That RTI and USAID really have, within the bounds of the policy pronouncements and within the bounds of the funding flow that they've had, undertaken very important and very useful efforts. But the magnitude and consistency of our efforts in local government development really haven't matched the magnitude and the importance of the problem. I think Ron pointed out and Michaela both pointed out the absolute centrality of local government in terms of the structure of the Iraqi government. I think one thing I would also point out is in terms of the development of the Iraqi polity, the consolidation and transformation of Iraq into a democracy, local governance has a real central, a critical central role. And it is not just in terms of the structure of the government system, but it is also in the process of turning a fragmented society that is not structured and is not used to engaging in a political process in a representative way into a polity that is able to do that. I would contrast it with Kosovo. If you look at the history of the development of the conflict in Kosovo, by the time the international intervention came into Kosovo, you basically had, on the Albanian side, two political parties, the LDK and the PDK, who together were, first off, both organized as political parties with hierarchy, with organization, with individuals who were able to come to a negotiating table and sign a deal that meant something. That is, when Rugova or Thaçi, who were the two majority, actually did a deal with the UN, that actually meant something because they had organized political parties. There was a degree of consolidation. And it was meaningful in the Kosovo polity. Iraq is not structured that way. In contrast with Kosovo, where those two parties alone probably represented 85% of the population, and if you throw in the AAK, you probably represented about 95 or 98% of the population, the four largest political organizations in Iraq, Skiri, Dawa, and the two Kurdish parties, probably only represent 40% of the population, and there is a distinct obvious bias in terms of who they represent. So local government and local governance processes and local government governance development processes really have a potentially critical role in the consolidation of representation in the development of the political system. And Dan's cousin's email really is very cheering in that regard, because what it means is, despite our problems and despite our mistakes in our approach to local government, that consolidation is really beginning to happen. I think the other thing that I would highlight is the critical role of local governance in kind of its civic importance and its role as a school of democracy. I think Ron and Michaela both pointed that out a little bit, but it's not just a technical problem. It really is a critical role in terms of citizens understanding the core processes of accountability, the acceptance of the notion that, in fact, they can hold people accountable, what the processes are, what reasonable expectations are, what the dynamics are, and that kind of thing. I think there also is an issue that Ron touched on very briefly that we might call kind of the creation of citizenship, or the lessening of sectarian identities and the weakening of sectarian identities. My colleague Stephen Ferry from Northern Ireland has pointed out that in Northern Ireland, if you look at voting patterns tend towards the sectarian at the higher level, but at the local level they are less sectarian than at the higher level, and that comes from a very simple phenomenon. It's very difficult to have a Protestant unionist versus a Catholic nationalist position on sewage treatment or potholes. And what that says is, and I think this is one of the core missed opportunities in the entire U.S. engagement in Iraq, it really highlights the role of local governance processes and local governance development in weakening sectarian identities and weakening the dynamics of identity politics and strengthening the dynamics of citizenship. Those are opportunities missed, but those are also opportunities that I think we really need to seize. I think Ron has touched on the importance of the basic components of a local government strategy. I just highlight the importance of a coalition for local government. That coalition needs to be not just in the as Ron understands it, not just in the politicians, but also within the political, within the people as a whole. Sunni desires for centralization and the assumption that a federal Iraq is a weak Iraq need to be addressed and need to be understood. And people have to understand the logic behind governance structures and how an effective governance system creates a strong state. You know, the observation that we're all familiar with, that by and large the strongest states in the world, both not just in military power but also in basic state capacity, are for the most part have some form of decentralized, devolved, or federal structure. So therefore our assumption about the strength of a federal institution is not something that the average Iraqi understands, and because they just haven't had a chance to think it through. So local governance processes have profound impact in terms of the understanding of democracy, in terms of the understanding of the importance of particular aspects of government structure, and therefore local governance is critically linked to the success of the democratization process as a whole. Ron has mentioned the importance of implementing legislation and regulation, capacity building in a technical sense, civic understanding and demand for democracy. One of the other things that I would also highlight is we need to understand that a local governance development process has to have a change plan. It's not easy to change a government structure where I was just talking with Jonathan Morgenstein yesterday. He pointed out that when he was in Ramadi, he had to go to Baghdad in order to get permission from the ministry to hire 12 garbage collection people for a neighborhood in the city of Ramadi. That obviously takes a while to change that process. So what do we need in terms of a local government program, and what do we have to ensure in that program and in terms of its implementation? First, I think we have to have it integrated with the political process. Obviously, at the national level, Ambassador Khalilzad has a strategy that is a politically led strategy. He understands and General Casey understands that we're not going to succeed in Iraq by a military led strategy. But what that means is that at the local level, we also have to have a local government development program that is able to adapt to that reality. That means we have to have a program that has to be adaptive and responsive. We can't just work in those places where we are able to work. We have to be ready to work and ready to push into those places where we need to consolidate nascent political deals and nascent cooperation. A program has to be integrated between local and national government capacity building. You can't develop the capacity of local government apart from the capacity, the procedures of national ministries. This is going to be a challenge because the tendency is, just from the way USAID does programs and from the politics of things and from budget dynamics and everything like that, you're going to have a tendency to have a local government program and national ministry development programs, and that means you have the potential for programs to develop in very different directions. Those people working in ministries naturally tend to see the situation from the point of view of ministries, and those people on the ground in local government tend to see it in that perspective. And so we have to integrate that program. Our local government program has got to be supported by and integrated with infrastructure reconstruction. Now, we're not going to be spending nearly as much money as we were, but just as one example of the damage done by our approach to reconstruction, I'll tell you the story. The first words that I heard out of the mouth of one of the senior leaders of the infrastructure program, he came and he started a briefing about what he thought his job was, and he said, I'm not a politician, I'm an engineer, I build things. I'm here to build a nation. And then what he proceeded to do was talk about how he was going to build the nation. What wasn't considered was the question of who was going to decide what dollars were going to be spent on what projects. And I mean, what everyone understands in this town, if you control the dollars, you've got political power. So it makes a difference what a ministry gets to decide, what a local government gets to decide. I think one of the things we have to recognize going forward is our efforts over the past 2 years, as hardworking as RTI and USAID have been, as the result of U.S. policy, we have systematically disabled local government, and therefore going forward, we really need to recognize that we really need a much more robust and comprehensive approach. Obviously, it's social change. It is an extended, it's not just technical training. You can train a bureaucrat relatively quickly in whatever it is you're doing, accounting standards or sewage treatment plant management or whatever. But changing that larger bureaucratic system, as well as helping citizens understand and change their relationship to the bureaucrat, takes time. So it's got to be an extended program. I think we have to include the police for a variety of reasons. I mean, we can just say the Interior Ministry is not exactly demonstrating a solid community policing approach to things. But the centrality of the police in terms of the everyday experience of government by the average citizen has got to get recognized, and we've got to get those ideas engaged from the beginning. I think the program has to be linked to other democratization efforts, including larger scale civic education and civil society development programs. The growth of municipal or of local government is not just something that takes place through a series of technical meetings. It's also got to be explained to the larger society. That means strategic communications and mass media. It's got to be funded. That should goes without saying, but unfortunately the reality is that it is also going without doing. The program has got to be funded. It's got to be funded at the level to have the impact that it needs to have. I mean, obviously the importance of this in linking to the insurgency, the proposal for provincial reconstruction teams is a recognition that we pulled out of the provinces and pulled out of a robust local presence far too early in our adventure in Iraq. And unfortunately, that came about as a result of funding flows and funding dynamics rather than any diagnosis about what was needed or what was not needed. The move back to the PRTs is very important, but a PRT is not a development tool. It is an organizational and logistics tool. The work of developing local government still needs to be done by local government experts. I think, you know, the reserves and the civil affairs community can do a lot of good work. They need to be integrated with USAID programs as an adjunct, and USAID needs to pay more attention to training and incorporating and using the military in its local government efforts, but the military can't do it, and PRTs are a mechanism for getting local government development activities out into the province. They're not the way to do it itself. And I think that'll be the last of my comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dana. You know, the most feared and respected person in Washington is the well-informed congressional professional staff member. And we have a terrific one here, Patrick.
The joy of going last. It's rare that, actually, I want to start by saying thank you to Dan and USIP for the invitation. The subject of Iraq is one that I've been riveted on, like most of you have, since I got a phone call and 3 years ago from my reserve commanding officer saying, pack your bags, you're heading off to the desert. So we had a hearing of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on February 11th with a couple of members. It's a quick introduction on my part to the issue. I said, can I work this hearing and have the briefings beforehand and learn what's going on afterwards? But I've also was there in the first Gulf War. So I've had this on my brain for several years, and I wanted to go after the war. The shooting part of the war was over. As some of you know, you saw me in Baghdad. I was seconded to USAID and and work with them on in some of the initial phases of the planning and reconstruction. I didn't want to see anybody have to go back 12 years later and do it again. So we're still working on it. We're still getting working to get some of this stuff right. I'm glad to see that many of you are still interested, that the subject of Iraq still draws a crowd. Either that or there's an employment problem in Washington. You guys need jobs. It's rare that I get to articulate my views. Usually I'm sitting behind the back and posing questions and trying to get others to articulate their views. So I know this is on the record and all that good stuff. So if I say something controversial, it's my opinion. If I say something smart and astute, it's the chairman's view, okay? But I'm also here to listen and learn. I have a role in this mission, and as does the SFRC and Chairman Lugar. And what I take joy in this kind of event, because it means that we're thinking about the harder issues. Senator Lugar has not been one at all who said this was going to be easy or that this was going to be a short-term effort. And it's obvious that it's not. He came to me, started talking earlier in late part of October, getting very frustrated about the tenor of the debate. That after, you know, 3 years of almost constant barrage of media reports about, after 3 years of think tank experts and scholars and meetings like this about Iraq, the best we could do for a debate was to say, should we bring the troops home, or should we leave them there and finish the job? Rather disappointing to a man who likes the big issues, who's willing to grapple with the big issues. And it's great to work for a guy like that, too. So anyone who's spent an hour or a day in Iraq knows that was it your nephew?
My cousin.
Your cousin, okay. Knows that U.S. troops do not want to stay in Iraq any longer than they have to. Anyone who spent any time visiting with Iraqis knows that they don't want us there any more than we want to stay. Okay. But both the Iraqis and our own troops, as well as our civilian experts, know that the Iraqi state is not able to stand on its own, and we need to stay there till it is stable. Victory, I don't know, success, stability for sure. We need to establish a degree of stability so that Iraqis themselves can say, I want to be an Iraqi and I want a part of this. And then we'll start seeing success or victory. When Iraqis decide that they want to be Iraqi, that they don't want to be Sunni or whatever subsection of the population we're dividing them in on a regular basis, when they want to say, because we know that Iraqi identity is there. Many of you have been there. You know that Iraqi identity is there. It's been beaten down over the last 30 years, but it is there. I had a great dinner when I was there. Mikhail and I had dinner at the Chancery when I was there in November. It was a cultural affairs type dinner. It was a great event. What did we have? Chairman of the English Department of Baghdad University, archaeologist, author, writer, philosopher, and all kinds of folks around the table talking about what makes up that Iraqi character and how we get back to it. So there are plenty of people there who are still dreamers and who still want to get back to that. And I think we're getting there. But it's necessary that we speak forthrightly about the challenges that we face in our military and civilian missions. American people deserve more than simplistic rhetoric. It's incumbent upon you professionals, we professional staff in the Congress, members of Congress, USIP, other NGOs, C-SPAN, who is not broadcasting this today, but if you watched yesterday, you saw numerous such meetings around town being broadcast. It was a good one at AEI yesterday. It talked about some of the harder issues. It was great, great TV watching for those of you that couldn't get to sleep last night. Congressional hearings have a role in that too, but in elevating the quality of the rhetoric. But too often, we have to compete too for that public attention, and often those hearings turn theatrical or turn into some partisan sniping, which rarely helps. So with that lengthy throat clearing out of the way, some of the assumptions that you guys have started on, I'm going to read my notes since we all prepared notes separately, so as sometimes happens. We made certain assumptions in coming in this room, I think, that we here in the United States would probably agree with. One, that local governments are important. Two, that Iraqis need local government. Yeah. Head nods, anybody? Come on. You with me? All right. The other thing that we assume, I think, is that forces outside Iraq can and should influence the formation and effectiveness of those institutions. Can we? Yes. Should we? Yes. Okay. We get head nods there. So we agree on that, too. Now, how do we go about doing that? We have several plans. RTI's got a noble plan. They've been there for 2.5 years, built a tremendous infrastructure around the country, little camps, bunch of trailers, bunch of people, trained a lot of locals, invested, I would argue, not a small amount of money, $250 million or somewhere in that, $235-$250 million. Okay, so not a small amount of money in this program. If you think about the large amounts of money, okay, it's small. But we also have to remember that about 95 cents of every dollar spent in Iraq over the last 3 years has been military spending, not civilian spending. And if you divide that nickel even farther, 25% of that's been to security. I don't know how much of it's been wasted. I don't know how much of it's, you know, been destroyed by infrastructure challenges and insurgent attacks too. So it dwindles even farther. We can talk about money in another forum, but it's worth noting. But local government's capacity is absolutely essential, I think, to the future of Iraq. Local governments, there's probably a way that we can reach an easy definition, and kind of talked about those. Ron threw some slides up there, but we want them to be able to keep the streets safe and clean. Want them to be able to deliver basic utilities or maybe contract them out. We want them to help to run decent schools. We want them to provide service to those who can't provide them for themselves. And we want all these things, all these actions, as my colleagues have mentioned, to be delivered by duly elected officials in a democratic manner. There are other sub-elements involved in all these, but I think those are the main basic ones that we look for, the things we need a government to do. Who's going to do that in Iraq? Have they been elected there? We've had some provincial councils since January of 2005, but those guys didn't really have resources. I think in the 2006 budget, each province is getting $1.6 billion from the central government. That's a start. How are they going to do that? What are they going to do with that? That's Iraqi money, which is great. How that's going to be implemented, I think we can be helpful. The international community, the royal we, can be helpful in helping them spend that. And where do they build that capacity or develop? I think the Iraqis are capable. I think most of us would, that they do have this capability. I'm not sure that they know they are. Okay, we have to. It may be part of our role to remind them that they're capable. You know how to do this. You don't have to wait. You know, I sat at long hours with Ministry of Interior officials in November. Some of them get it. Some of them don't. One was coming to me with I don't know who he thought I was. Something got lost in the translation, but he was listing his complaints, things that need to be fixed in the MOI. And I whispered to the CPAT advisor sitting next to me. I said, "Why is he telling me this?" He's like, "Ask him." So I asked the deputy ministers of interior. I said, "What are you doing about this? You're the deputy minister in charge of police. Why don't you change the colors of uniforms from blue to brown if you like the brown ones better?" Seriously, I mean, that was one of his complaints. "We don't like the blue uniforms." Okay. So, you know, when we say I laugh too, but I was, but that is. They need direction. It's the Ba'athist kind of, the small B Ba'athism, and they're beating down people to make sure that they go and get everything in writing, get a receipt, get everything cleared before they go forward. We push military trained folks, push that authority down to the lowest level. Geez, the garbage has got to go out. I don't care when you do it; it's got to go out by Tuesday. You know, the trash guy comes at 6 a.m. Get it out. Whenever you put it out, I don't care what it goes out in. Just do it. So we try and do that, and I think that's some of the capacity building that we're talking about. But who's going to do that? I think when we talk about the elections that are coming forward, it's been a great pleasure to watch the news, and I think we'll see the final results announced. The IMIE is supposed to announce their their omni-domini or whatever they're going to say about the election results, which will clear the IECI to announce official results probably Saturday, and then maybe we'll see a government seated by mid-February. And 60 days after that, the law says they've got to have local and provincial elections. I don't think the IECI is going to be able to do it in March, but maybe by June they'll be able to do 700. That's the number I got yesterday from IFAS. 700 local elections, 700 different local elections. So that's what we're talking about in building this capacity. You guys up to it, Ron? you got that?
I heard the number.
Yeah, 700. Some of it's been going on. Some of it we can do now. Some of it's been going on already, as you know. Civil affairs folks have been there right behind the combat force since 03, been doing great jobs at the local level. I'm sorry they couldn't be with us today to comment on what they've found. I think they're some of the best views. Some of them in the audience perhaps can share some of their views. Our NGO friends, such as Mercy Corps, I think Mercy Corps folks are here somewhere. They were. They snuck in, snuck out. Have been doing with USAID and some of the other ICAP partners, have been building these capacities at the local level. I've been a huge supporter, and Senator Lugar's been a huge supporter of that program. Small dollars, small security, great impact. Okay, can we point our finger to it and say this is in place? No, but people, they can. Great briefing last week by those folks that came up and talked to me. I think Michaela was out. We're at the beach somewhere, where were you?
I was at Camp Pendleton with the first
one. Oh, playing with the Marines in the sand. Center for International Private Enterprise has done a lot of great work with Chambers of Commerce and those kinds of institutions, different sort of institutions that need to be built. RTI, obviously, you spent hundreds of millions in their LGP project. The PRT plan, after my trip in November, I wrote a report available on the web. There's the one that looks like. Also, it says for sale. For sale by the superintendent of documents. So I've been officially published. Am I allowed to do book plugs here?
Well, yeah, you are, and it's out on the table.
Oh, all right, great. And in it, I kind of lay out some of my initial gut feelings towards the PRTs. It's not a once. My challenges are one, collaboration. The PRT concept appears again to be a large scale U.S. imposed solution. And when I asked the folks that briefed me, the Iraqis asked for this. Did they want this? I got a diplomatic response from someone who I'll leave, because I respect him immensely, and I know he was in a difficult position. He said, I just spent 2 hours with him, with Prime Minister Joffrey. I said, oh, okay. So, in other words, no. When we participated early on in strategic planning sessions, we would say, I point here to Paul Hughes, who was part of the strategic planning team in the summer of 03, why are there no Iraqis in this room? Well, it would take too long if we had them here. I mean, that was some of the answers we got. I don't know. It does take longer, but that's what, as you guys know, that's what takes time. That's what's important. It's building an institution. It takes time. Personnel, I mean, a PRT plan is going to demand personnel. The civilian components of our government have not been successful since General Garner set out with his team in early 03, have not been successful in finding sustained levels of support for their mission from individuals or parts of our government, either way, qualified civilians to serve lengthy tours of duty. I don't see any evidence that this is changing. USAID's not full up round. They don't have a full up round in the chamber right now out there. State Department's struggling, although they will say they're better than they were a year ago. They're talking about maybe having mandatory assignments. I think the Secretary's announcement today was, or yesterday and today was part of that, saying it's going to be harder to be a Foreign Service officer because you're going to have to go places you may not want to go. And that's the thing we need to do, is raise those expectations that you may not be able to go to Paris or Rome all the time when you want to. Civil affairs teams have been all over the place and really highly taxed. Security forces and protection, I think it's a great challenge. We can't put civilian teams out there in Fort Apache. The insurgency is still going on. the insurgents will figure out where they are and they will run them over. No doubt about it. You know, we can't put them out there without the military, without a forward operating base in many of these places. So one size fits all, and you can't really go around the country like stormtroopers either. The security restrictions that the State Department operates under are very different from what the military can do, and sometimes they don't work well together. And mission integration, as Dana said earlier, we need to integrate this at all levels with the police training, with reconstruction. I also offer as it's kind of a point of theatrical conversation that what are the models in Iraq that I'd like to see maybe some of the scholars talk about for local governments, local government capacity building is, what do we have in Kurdistan? And how did the Kurds get there? Well, I think that the answer, how the Kurds got there, is Operation Northern Watch, okay, and a dozen years of solid coverage on that, and I've got many friends who've flown those missions over the years. But I also ask, if that's the way we get there, as a counterpoint, I'll argue with myself, that is the Kurdish model a worthy one? Are the Kurds democratic in their own right? Are we kind of ignoring what the Kurds bring to the table now in their model of government? I think those are points for not a definite conclusion, but I think I also think on a daily basis what the SFRC can do about this, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee can do about this, and my boss, and I'm willing to hear your thoughts and comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. I can't help but note that we've worried about local governance before. I remember when a number of us were successful in convincing the powers that be to run the municipal elections in Kosovo first. And the trouble was we forgot to empower the municipal governments with money or authority or something like that. But it was right to run the municipal elections first. And I think there really is an urgent need now that the national government has been legitimized with democratic elections. The Constitution is wise to require local elections within 60 days, it seems to me. I'm going to open the floor to comments and questions. There is a microphone. John, if you want to. I have to make people go to the microphone because otherwise it's a little bit hard to hear. So please do line up if you have comments or questions. And introduce yourselves first.
Thanks. And John Blackton from Creative Associates. And although I really should respond to the grand themes that the panel has set up, because I think you've very eloquently posed some of the big challenges, I'm going to be a real Washingtonian and ask a kind of inside the beltway question about where the U.S. government is going with all of this. And it's a question that's partly to Mikhaila and partly to Patrick, because it's partly about intentions and operations, and it's partly about money. And although you're an authorizer, not an appropriator, you're closer to the money than the others. So Mikhaila and Patrick, in the last couple of years, the local government project, the LGP, has been the centerpiece of what the U.S. government was about in local governance, and we're reaching a kind of a changeover point. We've seen a recent announcement of a very grand strategic cities project. Looking out over the next couple of years, is that strategic cities program going to be the centerpiece of local governance? Is there more to it? Could you fill in a little bit what the government's going to do in the next couple of years in local government? And for Patrick in particular, you say its piggy bank seems almost empty right now in terms of discretionary money to do any of these things. What are the prospects for refilling their piggy bank for local governance and non-engineering kinds of work?
Mikhaila?
And I didn't ask him to ask that question, Patrick, but it's obviously one on the forefront of our minds as well.
In terms of where we're going, we are in the process of developing the USAID strategy for 2006 through 2009. It has not been finalized, but I can assure you that local governance is not diminished in any importance. It may be recast. You mentioned what we currently have. For those of you who may not have seen it, we currently have an RFA on our website looking for partners to work on what we're calling focused stabilization. Clearly, from our perspective, local governance is a key component to achieving the stabilization of these key cities. We may be calling it different things rather than focusing it on a subsectoral level of local governance, casting it in a broader strategy that fits the broader U.S. government policy and does some of the things that our colleagues here on the panel have mentioned in terms of how do we build the collaboration and how do we integrate with the military, as Patrick recommended. So it may be cast in a different way, but I don't think you'll see any diminishment. Another piece of the strategy is focused on capacity building, and capacity building of humans, individuals, but also of institutions and systems, which will also obviously need to be taken to that local governance level.
Patrick?
yeah. Absolutely, I agree. No, yeah, AID's coffers are running dry. If they're not, if there's not already dust and if they're not already picking up the dust.
You're telling me that local governance is the aspirate?
Well, no, I'm saying that I want to see, as staff, I'm looking to the administration for a robust request. I talked to some of my colleagues on the Appropriations Committee, and they look more money for that, and I said, absolutely. You ready to quit? There are some folks in the administration think that there's not a stomach for a large supplemental. There never is. Nobody ever wants to see a large supplemental, but it's necessary. If you look back at the numbers that we came up with when, or that somebody came up with in asking for an $18.5 billion supplemental for civilian reconstruction needs, that's still probably a pretty good number. But where is all that money gone? You know, if you went back and you said, okay, if we pulled $2 billion off the plate and gave it to DOD to do police and military training, maybe that's a good number to look for back. I think it needs at least $2 billion, probably $1 billion a year, $1 billion a year in ESF for the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we can squeeze that. I mean, it's got to come from somewhere. But I think that makes sense. It's an we made this investment so far. It's kind of like the old bait and switch for a construction project in some ways. Well, you know, we got you halfway to Brooklyn. You know, you got to buy the other half of the bridge now. Otherwise, you got to come back. So how do you, you know, we're at that point. We're half. You know, I don't know if we're halfway, but I hope we are. We're going to need to put more money in the coffers.
Just a comment. My last trip to Iraq was August and September, and I worked on, among other things, the red cell for Ambassador Khalilzad, which generated the clear, hold, build strategy. And in terms of the conception and the numbers of how the assumption was that there was going to be a coherent nationwide local government program, because you need local government everywhere, and you also need a national level program for local government. The Strategic Cities Program was designed to be that rapidly adaptive piece that would not only be able to match the military, because you can't jerk Ron Johnson's RTI around. That has happened enough, but it's something less than desirable. But the Strategic Cities Program is that adaptive piece. It's also the piece that gives you the extra resources that you need if you have to go to Ramadi and to Fallujah and to Tal Afar and to other areas. So it gives you an additional capacity in addition to a focused economic development and infrastructure capacity. So that was the idea. The numbers on local government and strategic cities alone that we generated are on the order of $1.5 billion to $2 billion a year for local government and focused economic development and that kind of thing. So those are the numbers that we were talking about then, but that was before Katrina.
I just want to insert a quick advertisement for U.S. Institute of Peace in the sense that we have built over the last 2 years a network of Iraqis trained in facilitating interethnic dialogue, calming interethnic tensions, and it's very much my hope that when the time comes and USAID is able to put a lot of money on the street for the Strategic Cities Initiative that they will draw on some of those Iraqi partners of USIP who are ready and willing and, in fact, conducting with extremely small amounts of money from us really vital interethnic activities in a number of the northern and central governorates, the more mixed governorates of Iraq. Please.
Thank you very much. Paul Ofeni from Emerging Markets Group, and my question is to any of the panelists. I think it was in last weekend's press that we read that Condi Rice has commissioned a study, an interagency study, of the PRT activities in both Afghanistan and Iraq. I'd be curious to know a little bit about the, if any of you know about the terms of reference for this analysis. How would USAID, for example, be engaged in that interagency study or analysis, which will include field work? And the local governance, which we've talked about today, is that specifically part of the terms of reference of this group? I presume their mandate is get in, get some answers, and get back and report to the secretary. At least that was my sense in reading the press this weekend. Any comments on that? And why do you think that the administration is looking at Afghanistan and Iraq at the same time, looking at that U.S. government model of operations, and again with the underpinnings of what's in it and what's expected to be looked at with respect to local governance? Thank you.
Wants to respond, Michaela?
Sure. I can start at least, although some of my colleagues may have something to add. In fact, a study is already underway of the PRTs in Afghanistan. It was a joint effort with state and DOD and AID participating in the panel of experts reviewing the program. They did travel in country extensively. They are currently writing the report, so it is not yet available for release. They're still revising it. There was an initial draft. I have not even seen it. I mean, right now it's with the team that is drafting it. I think it's premature for us to actually consider any sort of a review of the Iraq PRTs in terms of an evaluation or assessment. To date, we've only set up three of them, the first one having been stood up in November in Mosul, and subsequently in Kirkuk and Hilla. Obviously, that doesn't mean that we don't do ongoing monitoring and evaluation as it unfolds. It's one of those things that you have to constantly evaluate. I think part of the reason that we're looking at it is we're, again, it goes back to some earlier comments of trying to get an understanding of how we collectively in the U.S. government work cooperatively and collaboratively in these types of situations of the Iraqs and the Afghanistans, and recognizing that you asked specifically why look at them jointly, and part of it is to recognize that Iraq and Afghanistan are very different countries, very different contexts, and we have a very different approach, and yet at the same time we're also looking at the PRTs as a model that can be revised or adapted within a different context. So we're trying to ask a lot of the same questions and see where we get the same answers, but where we get very different answers, so that we as a government are most appropriately informed for being able to act in these types of environments, as well as recognize what we can ask our NGO and private sector partners to do in these types of environments, and what types of things we need to provide as a foundation for them to be able to implement as well. I think that was all of the questions.
The question, if you will, would be the terms of reference. Do they really include, or do you know if they included local governments?
I'm sorry. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, because the way we at AID think about PRTs is PRTs are not a program. We see them as a platform, an approach, and the real goal of a PRT is to capacitate the local entities, government, civil society, independent media,
all the various stakeholders, as well as coordinate with the donor community. So they become an approach. They are not in and of themselves a program or a deliverable. It is trying to get at some of the things that I think Patrick rightly raised, which is how do you engage the local population? And the PRTs are, I hate to say the word experiment, but they are an attempt to bring all of those stakeholders together to ensure that we're not undermining local institutions, local leaders, local government entities, but rather recognize that usually it's the international community that's coming up with the money, at least initially, while we work on the central budgets being devolved to the local level. But in the meantime, some of that initial seed money has to come from the donor community. And so we're looking at how we can bring that together, meet the local needs as identified locally.
I haven't seen the terms of reference, but one of the things that I would comment on is the importance in discussing the PRT. Is recognizing that, as Michaela pointed out, a PRT is not a program. A PRT is a bus. It's a way of getting people someplace to do something. It's a heavily armed bus it's a Winnebago with a place to live and a lot of guns in it, but it's still just a bus to get people there. And sometimes, because what we did when the transition from CPA and DOD funding to State Department funding, and the State Department said, my God, your toilet paper and paperclip budget is bigger than our budget. We can't get people out there. We can't have people in every province. We can't pay for the security. And as a result, for purely operational and financial and logistical reasons, we withdrew from the provinces. And the PRTs, I think, represent a recognition that, you know, if you're going to change a place, the more contact you have, the better. And most of the discussions of PRTs that I have seen tend to conflate the two things, and we really have to be very careful in thinking about the difference between the program, the engagement, the development process versus the bus that gets people there.
If you're looking, just a quick plug, if you're looking for a good analysis of PRTs, read Bob Pareto's study from October 2005. Published by
USIP.
You said that?
I didn't know.
Anyway, it is available, actually. The staff will quickly get some copies to put out on the table while you're waiting for the government report. We do intend, by the way, to have a discussion of PRTs and their applicability in Iraq and how they're very different in Iraq in many respects. Once the government study is done, we'll have a discussion of that along with the USIP study. Please.
My name is Sarah Warren. I'm with Mercy Corps. And thank you, Patrick, for the on our behalf, Mercy Corps' behalf, and the Community Action Program partners of USAID for the little plug of our program. As we said at our little briefing on the Senate side last week, we actually aren't able to talk very much about what's happening and what we've been able to achieve because of the security situation. So it's sort of, sadly, an unsung program and set of successes in Iraq. But we have, in fact, the five CAP partners managed to achieve, I think, a huge amount in building up local capacity. The way that we talk about it at Mercy Corps is that we're building a grassroots constituency for democracy. And I think that in terms of creating that ability of the Iraqi people to take this forward for themselves and on their own, there are probably three key elements. One is the resources to support them in doing that. Two is helping them build the skills, because many people have just not had that opportunity over the last 35 years. And three is, I think Patrick clearly and articulately explained before, a lot of it is about confidence. My experience in talking to Iraqi people is that they don't feel like they know how or like they have somehow the power to make decisions for themselves or to organize things for themselves. And so oftentimes it's just giving them the tools and then giving them a chance to do it. And we find that our national staff are actually really running the show for us for the most part now. and the local community groups that we work with are actually making these decisions, identifying priorities, and they are really leading the reconstruction process in their communities. So that's my plug for the Community Action Program. And just to say, I really hope that whatever framework does go forward includes not only looking at local governments, who we do work with through that program, but also the people really at the community level and how we continue to link those communities to the local governments. My question for the panel, unfortunately, I hope this doesn't get to be too repetitive, but I am interested in the PRTs. Why in the USIP study, I thought two of the most interesting conclusions were related to the expansion of PRTs into other areas, and in particular into Iraq. The final statement of that study says that it would be inadvisable to take the PRTs into Iraq because this Iraq is too unstable, the cities are too big, and it would be inadvisable to try to use this model in a place that was so violent. So I'm curious to know, since the U.S. government study hasn't been completed yet, and this excellent and I think only definitive study that's come out so far in Afghanistan doesn't recommend going into Iraq with this model at this point, why are we doing it?
You got that grenade?
Yeah, no. I think there's the clear hold build strategy is based on a, I think, I can't, it is based on an implicit and, in my case, explicit critique of how we have conducted the military strategy thus far, based on the recognition that if you have a military strategy of whack-a-mole, right, God, there's some bad guys over there, run over in the corner and whack them. Bad guys are over here, and you run over here. That what you do is you get really tired, you annoy a lot of people, you may catch the bad guys eventually. And the clear hold build strategy within which the PRT is an implementation tool says, look, the way you fight a counterinsurgency is, by and large, you center on the population and the security of the population. Now, the security of the population alone doesn't give you a victory in counterinsurgency because the secure population is a concentration camp. It's not a democracy. So, therefore, you clear. That's the first step. You hold. You don't go running off in that corner, checking, you know, playing whack-a-mole someplace else, and then you build. But it's not, for the most part, physical infrastructure, although that is important. What you build is a sense of participation and a sense of potential that you have to build in the community that you now secure, a connection to the larger Iraqi political democratization development. And, you know, this thing went through about five or six names, and it finally ended up with PRT. Gosh, why was it PRT? I don't know. One can speculate why. Maybe
Calazad.
Yeah. What was that? I'm sorry. I missed that.
One word.
Yeah.
Calazad.
Yeah.
Two words.
It's a vehicle for doing that, and it's a vehicle for after clear, after hold, for building. So.
Ron, I was going to ask you if you want to comment on this from a contractor's perspective.
I'll comment not obviously to the policy question because the policy question is a government question. But remember the USIP study, the principal point that it made about one of the principal purposes of the PRT program in Afghanistan was to extend extend governance institutions into the provinces in Afghanistan where governance did not exist. In Iraq, you have government in the provinces already. You have elected government, obviously, to be reelected within 60 to 90 days from now, depending on whether you're talking about the sub-district or provincial level. So the fundamental purpose on the political side of the PRT in Afghanistan and Iraq, two fundamentally different purposes. The purpose of the PRT in Iraq is to support the Iraqi governmental institutions that already exist and to help them attain the other legitimacy. Recall that I talked about the legitimacy of being elected and the legitimacy of delivering on the kinds of things that citizens would expect of government. And there is some distance, some gap to fill there. And the PRT program in Iraq is intended to support the capacity to meet that other test of legitimate political institutions. So they serve two very different purposes, and for that reason, at some level, the use of the same term, the use of the same three letters to describe the program is, even Ambassador Khalilzad in a briefing in Baghdad in December that I attended, he remarked that maybe that was not such a good choice of the name for the program, recognizing that we're really not talking about the same thing.
Yeah, that I would say, I would underline that point. If you ask Bob Perito, who wrote our study about this, he'll say, look, I was writing about PRTs as executed in Afghanistan. Could they be transferred to Iraq? And the answer to that question is no. But if you're going to change the PRTs, if you're going to make them much more committed to local governance, for example, whereas in Afghanistan they were committed to strengthening the central government, if you're going to put them on real forward operating bases and not have just a small number of troops assigned to them, well, that's a different thing. And therefore, that can be put into Iraq, but to call it a PRT is to stretch the definition of a PRT quite a bit. So, but all of this is worthy still of more discussion, and we'll hold another whole meeting about that. Ray.
Ray Jennings, Creative Associates. And it's just that kind of discussion, which is I'm very glad and thankful that you guys are sponsoring it today. Thanks to USAID and USIP for doing so. I was wondering if you could elaborate on the connection that you'll see between local government and local security institutions. Now, Dana, you touched on this. But as local governments, they're going to be the frontline face of the Iraqi government. And we know from working out there that the top priority of local residents is security. So who are they going to go to when things aren't going well in security? And if there's no formal connection between local governments and their ability to work with local policing structures, this could be a huge frustration. So, Dana, since you brought it up, could you elaborate?
Yeah, no, and this is a huge pothole in multinational force Iraq's road to American troop withdrawal. The logic of MNFI's campaign plan is as you develop local security forces, you turn over local control to those local forces. And there is a presumption on the part of multinational force Iraq that there is some civilian or some coherent process of control. And this is a real gap. There really is not a structure for, let alone a structure. There isn't even an understanding of the role of local councils of the governor in civilian control of the military. So the question of what role, what influence, how do they integrate into that process is not particularly worked out. At least it wasn't as of last fall, and I suspect it's not yet. So the relationship, the civil military issue is an absolutely central, underthought, underaddressed issue. I mean, the mechanisms of civilian control of the military at the highest levels are not worked out, let alone relationship between national forces and local leadership in the context of local security control, and then you throw in the American role that you can only imagine kind of what happens. That there was the incident recently with Colonel Taha, the U.S. wanting to transfer the control of the western part of Baghdad to an Iraqi brigade in a dispute between the Ministry of Defense and the United States and Ministry of Interior in terms of who was going to be in charge. Well, imagine that two steps down the line when things have changed and, you're talking independent Iraqi operations. So that's an absolutely central problem. It's absolutely under-addressed thus far as far as I can see.
One thing that has changed since you were there, though, Dana, is the fact that this issue is addressed in the Constitution, where it outlines what are locally controlled or locally defined issues and what are national jurisdiction. The problem is that the Constitution requires, in many areas, not just this one, requires enacting legislation.
Right.
So once again, what we're in is a situation where there needs to be an interim process until that legislation is drafted and the clean and clear lines of authority are established. And I mean, it's not a resolved issue. It is currently being negotiated, and we do have defense and interior and MNFI there trying to work it. But I think it goes to the crux of what Ron said during his presentation of the need for the legislation that defines the local, I think you called it a local government code. This is clearly one of those issues that will have to be managed in the meantime, but will not be resolved until the Iraqis are able to enact their own legislation to determine it.
Yeah, and it's not you also have the problem in the Constitution of local security forces, and so you have two layers of civilian control of the military which aren't addressed in a meaningful, implementable way, which is how do you control the local forces and what is the relationship of the national forces? Yeah.
Ron, I was wondering whether you would comment on Iraqi expectations. Do they expect to control security forces at the local level?
You know, I'm not the best person to comment on that at all, because in our program, as a USAID program, we have by legislation and, of course, by our practice in the project, not had any contact with the security issue. We've had a lot of contact with security issues, but we've not had any contact with our responsibility for addressing how the security is the Iraqi security will be organized.
Please. Hi, my name is Michael Stanisich. I'm with ProCare International. Until recently, I was with IOM, and I have a question concerning the RFP to a certain extent, a slight observation and an example of institutional development and capacity building in Iraq today. The question is, how do you foresee linking the local levels with the central government? Because if we proceed by empowering the local levels without having a program in place that decentralizes, very centralized Baghdad, we're going to run into some problems, and where how to mitigate that conflict when it arises, I'd be very welcome to hear your opinions on. Secondly, there was a remark concerning institutional development or capacity building of individuals versus institutions. I've managed the process of creating or helping to create one of the ministries within Iraq over the last 2+ years, and I don't think you can delink those. You can't proceed by trying to develop the institution and the individual separately. And following 2 years of interventions, we're just now starting to see some rubber hitting the road. And this is extensive intervention from the creation of the ministry itself, the mandate, the department's institutional framework, to what we have now has taken 2+ years. And we still have much, much more time to go. And so I suppose if you could address some of these concerns, I'd be much appreciated. Thank you.
I didn't mean to be interpreted as delinking them. All I was trying to do was when offering a definition of capacity building, mm-hmm. that in fact some people will interpret that as meaning one or the other. And what I was trying to say was that as we use the term capacity building within the Iraqi context, within USAID speak, we are looking at institutions, people, and systems collectively. I didn't. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you raised that. No, I'm glad you raised it, because I wouldn't want anyone to leave thinking that we were making that distinction, because I agree with you, it's a false distinction, and I hate to use analogies, but it is the three-legged stool. If you don't do all three and you do them concurrently and concomitantly, you're going to have the stool tip over. So in terms of the RFA and how we foresee local levels interacting with national, I think we're looking at it in a number of ways. It's important that we're empowering both national and local, but in terms of the exact linkages, we're looking at the budget linkages. I think that's probably the prominent one. We're also looking at the formation, as Ron mentioned in his presentation, of a local government caucus within the Council of Representatives. Also, Ron, probably out of time constraints, wasn't able to mention that also the one of the key foci of the local governance program in the past year has been in the formation of a local government association. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that, but I see that as a key linkage. We're also looking at a matter of communications, and that's within the central ministries to the local departments as much as it is with the provincial councils and ultimately with the municipal governments when they're elected. But, Ron, I think maybe...
Well, over the past year, we've spent a lot of time in most of the provinces trying to talk the existing council members at that and technical officials as well into the notion of thinking about how do you lobby with central government? How are you going to form yourselves? Interestingly, we found that there's a fair amount of resistance in the various provinces to joining with more than one or two other provinces. There has been interest in two or three provinces working together to form an association, a great deal of resistance to the notion of a national association of local governments because it sounds too centrist. It sounds too much like some central group. And so what we thought it was a natural, year and a half ago when we started working on these, we thought, well, obviously you'll come to see it as if you form a national association, you'll be a lot stronger. Well, that turned out to be a problem. The notion of a lot stronger did not translate as local government will be a lot stronger, but some group which will meet up there in Baghdad will represent us, and we don't trust those people up in Baghdad to represent us. But we have been successful in holding a lot of regional association meetings. Some of them are not so formally associated as a legal entity some have actually formed themselves under an NGO status in individual provinces. And a lot of the debate on the Constitution that did not take place in Baghdad took place in these meetings of province council members, a few members of the National Assembly who were on the drafting committee, not the same members, but it was not very difficult to get two or three members who were involved in drafting to come to meetings in the various provinces where you generally bring together two or three provinces together, and it would typically be the legal committee of the provincial council because of virtually every city council and provincial council in Iraq formed legal committees pretty early on to look at legal political issues. And so the process of influencing even the Constitution itself was through this kind of loose affiliation or loose association of key members of local government councils. That will continue, and of course it will particularly continue. One of the things that we tried to prepare them for is no matter what the Constitution says, it won't say enough. There's not any way that you can, and this is well before it became obvious that many issues were going to have to be resolved later, that constitutions generally, good constitutions generally don't specify everything. You have a lot of work to do afterwards. And so we got them to engage in discussion about what would have to happen afterward. I believe that many of the and our hope, of course, is that some of those provincial council members who participated in those dialogues will show up Saturday or Sunday or Monday on the list of members of the National Assembly. We're confident. We know of some who are so far up on the party list, and those parties did receive most of the votes in a province. We know there will be some number already. We just don't know whether it will be 10 or 15 or 30 or 40 or 50. Whatever number it is, those plus others who may not have served in local government would constitute a pretty effective voice, at least in terms of what it takes to run local government.
Jonathan?
Hi, my name is Jonathan Morgenstein. I'm here at USIP, and previously I was in Ramadi with the Marine Corps as a civil affairs officer. And I was talking with Dana about some of these issues yesterday, and one I was thinking about overnight was the prevalence, at least in the areas I was in, of the power of the tribal leaders, the sheikhs. And it's one thing for a national government to begin utilizing power and holding power, and maybe even at the provincial level, but when you start getting down to that local level of authority, ideally when we were there, we would want to build those up as parallel while still at the same time not threatening the sheikhs as much as possible because of the possible blowback of violence. When you start threatening the power of the tribal sheikhs at that local level, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on dealing with the potential backlash by the traditional power brokers in the area.
Before you respond to that, let me take the last question too, because time is fleeting and I want to go back through the panel as well.
My name is Jennifer Rosinski. I'm a civil affairs specialist with the 352nd Civil Affairs Battalion, and I was in Afghanistan last year, in Herat for 7 months and out in Logman for 3 months. And I just wanted to make some comments, actually, that I saw as the number one problem in Herat, the budget of the local governments. I know this has already been mentioned, but I just wanted to emphasize that. And as an example, that we worked a lot with the Social Affairs and Labor Department and the director of the department did not have enough money in his budget to feed the orphans that were under him in the state-run orphanages more than one meal a day, which I thought was appalling. And also along those lines, that the immense amount of foreign aid in the Herat area sort of disempowers the local government, because the local populace sees local agencies for foreign aid as having more power to provide social services to the citizens than the actual departments. And also along those lines, lack of coordination of those NGOs and foreign aid agencies to coordinate with the government disempowers them. And when I was in Logman, we were establishing a new PRT, and I just wanted to comment that I think it's very important to establish PRTs in the most contentious areas, because those are the areas that need the most help, where the government has the least amount of confidence and the least ability to provide social services to their citizens, which, you know, just continues the vicious cycle of insurgency and conflict. So,
thank you. I'm always impressed with the amount of knowledge that people bring to these meetings, and I thank you for that. There are a couple of questions on the table, including whether there's a certain parallel between the question of whether you have to be careful about tribal chiefs and have to be careful about NGOs and the competition for authority at the local government level. Let me ask you to comment on those questions as I go back through the panel for one last sweep, and you can add anything you like that you think should be said at this point. Patrick?
Are we answering these questions?
You can either answer these questions or say anything you like by way of summing up.
I was looking forward to Ron's answer on the tribal chief issue.
I'll wait till after your
turn. All right. I've been... I think this conversation has clarified my concerns, not necessarily calmed them, which I think you guys have a tremendous deal of work to do. It's not our job. It's not the United States' job. It's not the MNFI's job. It's an international challenge and increasingly an Iraqi challenge. And we need to remember that as we go forward. We need to help Iraqis develop solutions to these problems. We need to get, we meaning the international community, the UN, NGOs, international partners at all levels on the ground and help them realize that it's in their best interest to get there and to contribute. And because A failed Iraq at the national or at the local level is going to lead to long-term problems. I think the local level will probably be the source of more conflict than the national level. The national level seems to be developing along the right path, but it's these local institutions. It's having a local municipality whose border is really somewhere out there where the sand meets the sand from the next province, where the county sheriffs are going to duke it out at some point. You know, I mean, you just see that happening as we try to empower them, but then fail to give them the resolution and the skills to deal with those institutions. So I applaud the work of USIP in engaging on the issues and engaging on the ground of RTI for taking on this mission and USAID for its leadership and continuance and all you folks who contributed to the conversation. Thank you for inviting me. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Dana?
Yeah, I'll pass on Jonathan's question because you heard from me on that yesterday, and you'll hear from me tomorrow. And just on Jennifer's comments, I think all of those are critical issues. There are no simple answers. One just has to be aware of them and constantly addressing them. My final comment would be, I think the thing we've got to recognize at this point in our engagement in Iraq is that Iraq has been here before. This is not the first constitution that Iraq has had. It is not the first National Assembly that has been elected. It is not the first kind of beginnings of a rough democracy in Iraq. All that happened before in the British engagement in the 1920s. And obviously
it was a guy named Hammurabi at one point too.
Well, yeah, that's true, but that's it's a little bit more contemporary than that. And the only, and of course we all understand that the history of Iraq and how that engagement and what the problems were, I think the only thing that will determine whether we are able to help Iraqis continue to build a democracy and a stable democracy and to help stabilize the region is whether we continue to engage in all of these very difficult, messy, and long-term problems. We are not going to be able to engage by giving them the answers. We are going to have to engage in a genuine partnership, and that means time, and it means participation.
Ron, you going to answer tribal chieftains?
Sure. We have not really found in our work the last 2.5 years that we've not found that to be a huge barrier. We found a great map when we first started looking at Iraq that had, I think it's 80-something tribes, and it was mapped across the provinces, and even in provinces where, by other dimensions, such as Shia, Sunni, or Kurdish, or whatever, if you look at other characteristics and you would say that's relatively homogenous, even in those provinces where there's homogeneity, there's a great deal of heterogeneity, got that word out without stumbling on it, in terms of some of the tribal affiliations. But the one of the things to remember is, and not to exaggerate in terms of Iraqi tribal politics, is that bluntly there's a great deal of intermarriage among Sunnis and Shia and Christians and other affiliations, and there's a great deal of intermarriage among the tribes. They don't divide up that neatly. You don't have a clean, here is a tribal grouping. If you look at the Al-Tamimi tribe, for example, one of the largest tribes in Iraq, very prominent in Baghdad, very prominent in some of the Sunni provinces, there are about one-third of the Al-Tamimi tribe is Shia, and about almost two-thirds is Sunni, so that the tribal differentiations don't create automatic divisions. And so you don't have to deal with the fact in local government, when you're talking about a tribal affiliation, that you're somehow setting up a government as a parallel and potentially combative structure with the tribal affiliations, any more than some local government history in big cities in the U.S. in the Northeast and in the Midwest, when you had machine politics. I mean, you think of those as the tribes. Local government functioned, some cases efficiently, some cases brutally. It doesn't mean that we would want to emulate that, but I don't see them as combative forces, and that's not been our experience. In some cases, the tribal leaders are the most effective supporters of a strong local government, because one of the ways that it helps, it's very consistent with the notion of a Shura Council, which is very much a part of the tribal process, where you bring different leaders together in council to resolve an issue between tribes. That's translated very well into the local government council in many cases in Iraq. The Kirkuk city council, from its early initial, brought together tribal groups as well as different religious and ethnic groups. So it's I don't mean to suggest that it's therefore ignore it, but it's not the kind of problem we might think it is. I guess the other thing I would comment on, which is not a direct response to a question, but Patrick, you brought it up most acutely. Clearly, the critical problem in terms of this a program going forward is further engagement of the Iraqis. I'm not too concerned that the Iraqis were not consulted in creating the PRT program, because as Michaela and others have pointed out, it isn't a program. It's a framework. It's a way in which the U.S. is organizing its own resources. And yes, it would have been desirable to see more Iraqi engagement earlier on in some of those discussions. But the reality is that it's not creating a program. There are programs within the PRT framework, and those programs at the local level, by that I mean province and below, those programs are necessarily and inherently partnerships with the Iraqis. If they aren't, if we don't make that happen, then it can't possibly succeed. There isn't a chance for that. So I think that's a wise observation, Patrick, and one that I believe is recognized there in terms of all of the various parties that will have to implement the various programs going forward.
Michaela?
I'd like to go back to the tribal question a little bit, because I think it was something that we were very concerned in the early days that it would be set up as an alternative structure of government in competition. And so we did a lot of thinking in the early days of the program. And as Ron said, you know, when we realized that it wasn't necessarily an adversarial relationship, but it was one that we had to pay attention to, because, again, if the tribal leaders see what we're trying to do in democracy and governance as a threat to their power base, then we've made an enemy unnecessarily. However, we've had certainly situations where tribal leaders have actually run for election and been elected for council member positions. And I think what we're concerned about is where are the defined roles and responsibilities and the rules that govern and people's right to choose how they wish to be governed, and having an opportunity to influence that in some areas of their life, but then they might choose within other areas to respond within the tribal structures. You know, it's much like various associational life in the United States, where, you know, some of us choose to practice the rules of one religion versus another. And we have that freedom within our system of government, and it's a matter for Iraqis to define where those lines and rules and responsibilities are. In terms of some of the comments that Jennifer made, I think she's absolutely right. I mean, my answer on the PRT question is you don't need a PRT if you don't have a conflict environment or an unstable environment. You can cooperate in different ways. Really, what the PRT does is bring military assets to the table that, and when I use that in the military sense of assets, don't just mean people and things, but it's also the skills and experiences that they have. In terms of you know, the power of foreign aid and foreign NGOs disempowering the locals, there is a potential for that always, and it also comes down to who's trying to claim credit. What AID has done in its program, very much so through our partners such as RTI and Mercy Corps, and I know ACDI VOCA is here as well, has been actually to be behind the scenes and have the Iraqis taking the lead and being the face of the programs. Now, part of that decision, to be perfectly honest, was for security reasons, because, you know, we were seen as targets. You know, if it's an American and it's an American company, it's more of a target. But I think what we as an agency can take away from this is realizing that sometimes maybe we go into a country and we don't recognize that a lot of it is they have the skills and ability to do it for themselves, and they might need us backing them up. But it's why you don't see a lot of our own tooting our own horn, but rather recognizing that Iraqis are out there and Iraqis are doing this for themselves, but with us in the background. And I think that is an important model for future development. I guess in terms of the optional comment, I would say two things. I think we have to remind ourselves that democracy takes time. Forming local government takes time. And yes, a lot of the Iraqis have the skills, but we're also dealing with a population that has been brutalized and traumatized and needs to be able to recover. It continues to be brutalized by the insurgency, but has demonstrated incredible courage to be able to go out and vote in greater numbers than we vote in this country, which I find quite disparaging. I'm disgusted. I'll put that on the table. I mean, I think, you know, we see great numbers decrease in voting if we have rain. Here are Iraqis going out and vote when, you know, they're facing a suicide bomber. So I think I take that away, that we have a tremendous amount of respect for them. And I think that that's sort of the thing that gives me hope that we will ultimately achieve in a democratic Iraq is because of the risk-taking of the Iraqis. And finally, I'd just like to thank USIP for co-hosting this event with us. We hope that there'll be more opportunities to do that. And I'd like to thank you, Dan, for moderating. Very much appreciated.
Well, we're delighted to have had this opportunity. I'm glad you came back, Michaela, to this question of NGOs and the potential for displacing the
Iraqi government. I think we're actually blessed by the lousy security situation in this respect, because even the NGOs that are there with Iraqi citizens, and that's a blessing. But I wouldn't have wanted it to disappear unmentioned. As some of you know, Ashraf Ghani has been here speaking about this issue very, very clearly. He feels very strongly, I think rightly, that sovereignty has been impinged upon from time to time by assistance programs and by interventions that don't intend to, but which provide alternative means of providing services. And I think in Iraq, the security situation has made that perhaps less of a danger than it was in the Balkans, for example, where I think it was a very serious problem for a while, much less now that we're providing less assistance. I want to thank very much the panel and the participants for a very engaging afternoon, and I hope that some of you will not be too tired not to join us tomorrow morning at 9:30 when we'll be discussing who governs Iraq next. Thank you.